Unless otherwise indicated, Ratchet Book Club is intended for a mature audience. Viewer discretion is greatly advised. Welcome to Ratchet Book Club, where we read hood classics and good classics. I'm Derek. 916-633-1537, ratchetandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. Chapter 13. About 8 feet in width, the limestone-clad tunnel featured a low-barrel vaulted ceiling, but straight walls. Underfoot, the rectangular paving stones had been laid in a herringbone pattern, cast off by fat yellow candles and bronze sconces. Draftster light shimmered lambently along the walls and, with shadows, wove an ever-changing tapestry across the curve of the ceiling. This forbidding passageway appeared to be long, dwindling into a confusion of shadows and sinuous sylphs of light before an end could be glimpsed. I would not have been surprised to encounter Edgar Allan Poe, but there was no sign of him, nor of Honker and the nameless maniac. Although the cool, but not damp, air smelled surprisingly clean and free of moldy malodors, scented by nothing but raw limestone and hot candle wax, I expected bats, rats, roaches, scuttling mysteries, but at the moment, we had only crinkles. We proceeded hesitantly 10 or 15 feet when he said, "Stop there a minute." While we waited, he closed the secret door on the bookshelves from this side and then shut the iron-bound oak door to the alcove. Perhaps the intention was to minimize the effect of the blast on the tunnel if the library explosion occurred prematurely, before we had reached absolute safety. While Crinkles closed things behind us, Lori zippered open her purse and rummaged through it. She found the steel nail file. To her shock, with my free left hand, I snatched it from her. She expected me to throw it away, and when I didn't, she said, "Gimme." I pulled Excalibur from the stone, and only I have the power to use it, I whispered, going totally literary on her with the hope that this would charm her into acceptance. She looked like she wanted to take a swing at me. I suspected her punch would pack one hell of a wallop. Rejoining us, moving past us so arrogant and so sure of our timidity that he actually turned his back on us, Crinkles led the way. "Come on, come on, and don't think I haven't got eyes in the back of my head." He probably did. Everyone had back of the head eyes on his native planet. "Where are we?" I asked as we followed him. The core of him was such a tightly wound ball of psychopathic fury that he could make a direct and simple answer sound fraught with anger. "Going under Central Square Park about now." "I meant the tunnel. What is it?" "What the hell do you mean, what is it? It's a tunnel, you shit for brains moron." Also a white phrase. That is such a, oh my God. I don't know if it sounds racist for me to say that all of these phrases that they say in these books are white phrases, but in my mind, I just picture these are all white people anyway, so fuck it. I don't think there's any black people in this book. I don't know. We'll see, but I don't think so. I may not be remembering it right. But when they say stuff like quiff and fucking shit for brains, I'm waiting for somebody to say newsflash, jackass, or something like that. But for right now, we'll stick to this. Taking no offense, I asked, "When was it built? By who?" "Back in the 1800s, before anything else. Cornelius Snow had it constructed. The greedy, grasping bastard." "Why?" "So he'd be able to get around town secretly." What was he, a Victorian Batman or something? The tunnels connect four of his major holdings around the square. The belly-crawling capitalist pig. Throughout this conversation, Lori casts meaningful looks my way, wanting me at once to attack Crinkles with Excalibur. As enchanted swords go, the nail file left a lot to be desired. Mostly hidden in my hand, the flat length of steel felt stiff, but not as thick as a knife. The point wasn't sharp enough to prick my thumb. If Lori had been wearing spike-heeled shoes instead of white tennies, I'd have preferred to go out Crinkles with one of those. I responded to her increasingly exasperated looks with the broad expressions of a bad mime, telling her not to be impatient, not to be rash, just to give me time to find the right opportunity for nail file mayhem. So, what four major holdings do the tunnels connect? I asked Crinkles as we moved forward through wafting candlelight and clinging shadows. He listed them with increasing venom. His mansion, that pile of gaudy excess. His library, which is nothing but a temple to decadent so-called Western literature. His courthouse, that nest of poisonous judges who oppressed the masses for him. And the bank, where he stole from the poor and foreclosed on widows. He owned his own bank, I asked. How cool. Crinkle said, he owned most of some things and some of just about everything. The blood-sucking, black-hearted running dog. If 100 men had divided his possessions, every one of them would have been too rich to be allowed to live. Wish I'd been alive back then. I'd have cut the imperialist swine's head off and played kickball with it. Even in the inconstant candlelight, I could see that Lori's face was red and taut, with barely contained, one might almost say hysterical, frustration. I didn't need a facial language specialist to interpret her expression for me. Go, Jimmy, go! Go, Jimmy, go, go, go! Stab the bastard, sis, boom, ba! Sis, boom, ba is also a very old term. I'm not going to say it's a white term because I don't know, but it's an old term. Very. Also, my homeboy let me know that HBCU's bands are all patterned after Ohio State's band. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know how I feel about that. I chose instead to bide my time. She was probably wishing she had worn those spike-heeled shoes so she could take them off and tattoo my head. A moment later, we came to an intersection with another tunnel. A still gentle but stronger draft moved here. To the left and right, more sconces with additional fat yellow candles threw rippling curtains of light into a crawling darkness. I should have realized that across the passageways must underlie the town square, because each of the four holdings that Crinkles had bitterly enumerated was in a different block from the others, north, south, east, and west of the park. Nevertheless, I couldn't help but be impressed by the abruptly revealed complication of this subterranean structure. Looking left, right, back, and forward, I thought of the stone corridors and torch-lit chambers in old movies about a mummy's tomb. And in spite of our perilous circumstances, a thrill of adventure shivered through me. Crinkle said, "This way," and turned left. Before we followed him, Lori put her purse on the floor. She tucked it in shadows close to the wall, and the length of corridor along which we had walked from the library. If the nameless grinning Phoebe saw her with the handbag, the jig would be up. If you're willing to allow that our pathetic nail file scheme qualified as anything so grand as a jig. She seemed reluctant to leave the purse. No doubt she considered it an arsenal of makeshift weapons. We might be able to suffocate Crinkles with a powder puff. If she had a hairbrush, we could spank him severely. As we trailed after our guide once more, I said, "Why all the candles?" Crinkles grew less patient with me about a minute. "So we can see in the dark, you freaking idiot. But it's not very efficient. It's all they had back in the 1870s. Candles and oil lamps, you drooling imbecile." Once more, Lori began signaling me, by fantastical contortions of her face and a mad horse rolling of the eyes, that the time had come to stab him. Crinkles had declined so drastically in my affections that, against my better judgment, I was almost ready to carve him like Scrimshaw. I said, yes, but we aren't in the 1870s. You could use flashlights, battery-powered lanterns, those sparkless chemical tube flares. Don't you think we know that, you brain-dead jackass? But then the ambiance wouldn't be authentic. We proceeded several steps in silence before I could no longer resist asking, why does the ambiance need to be authentic? The boss wants it that way. I assumed the boss must be the nameless maniac, unless it was a Mr. Big whom he had not yet encountered. At some date, long after the initial construction, the last 10 feet of this corridor had been walled off. They had used a double width of concrete blocks with embedded steel rebar. Recently, half the blocks had been broken out. The rebar had been cut with an acetylene torch. To one side of the corridor lay a pile of rubble. We followed Crinkles through the gap in this partition, into the last portion of the corridor. Another iron-bound oak door stood open at the end of the passageway. Beyond, electric light from more ceiling fixtures, added decades after the original construction, revealed a large stone-walled room with massive columns and herringbone floor. Two stone staircases with stately ornamental iron railings climbed opposite walls to doors of brushed stainless steel. But for the stainless steel, there was a feeling of an occult temple about the place. Half the space stood empty. The other half contained rows of green filing cabinets with aisles between. Honker and the killer librarian stood beside the handcar with its depleted load of explosives and murmured conversation. Concerned the brighter light might reveal too much, I surreptitiously slipped the nail file into my pants pocket. Beaming at the sight of Lori and me, as if we were old friends arriving at a cocktail party, our smiley host came to us, indicating the encompassing architecture with a sweep of one arm. Some place, huh? The institution's historical records are stored on this level. What institution? I asked. We're under the bank. Lori said, I'll be damned. You're going to rob it, aren't you? He shrugged. Isn't that what banks are for? The Beagle Boys were already planting explosive charges at two of the columns. Chapter 14. Pleased with himself, the maniac pointed to a hulking piece of equipment in the corner of the room. Do you know what that is? Tell me, do you know what time it is? Tell me, do you know? Yeah, I know I'm from the West Coast. Yeah, I know go-go. Yeah, I spent time in D.C. Yeah, Chuck Brown is dope. But my groove was rare essence. And I still love the overnight scenario. I know a lot of folks don't. That's okay with me. I'm fine with that. Lori guessed. A time machine? Having come from a family in which non sequiturs are as common in conversation as adverbs, I had adapted to the young Miss Hicks style in short order. Although the maniac was intrigued by her, he wasn't always able to dance with her as I could, metaphorically speaking. His green eyes glazed, and his smile slightly rounded in a puzzlement. How could it be a time machine? He asked. At the fantastic pace science is progressing, she said, space shuttles and CAT scans, heart transplants, computerized toaster ovens, now cell phones you can carry anywhere, and lipstick that won't smear. Well, I mean, at this rate, sooner than later there's gonna be a time machine. So, if there has to be one, why not here and now? He stared at Lori for a moment, then looked at the equipment in the corner as though wondering whether he had misidentified it or whether it might in fact be a time machine. Had I made that same speech, he would have decided that I was either a head case or a mocking smartass. Annoyed or offended, he would have shot me. A beautiful woman, on the other hand, can say just about any damn thing, and men will seriously ponder it. You know, that's absolutely correct. 100% not a lie. You know how I know that? Because my beloved wife, Nisha. She says some of the most off-the-wall shit, and I just give it credence. Like, I don't even mean to sometimes. It's just like, you know what, that could work. And I'm not saying that like she is constantly just saying stupid stuff. She doesn't. She's brilliant. Like, she's a fucking nurse. She's fucking incredibly brilliant. And, I mean, like, she's getting a master's degree without even thinking about it. Like, she's just like, yeah, I love to learn. I love to learn. That's from Hip Hop Harry. Y'all don't know about that shit. But it's like every so often she'll try and tell a joke, and it is just such a try that I have to stop and really ponder. Was she serious? Are you serious right now? Are you fucking shitting me, Bob? But yeah, no. Beautiful women get away with a lot of things that I, as a beautiful man, cannot. Her guileless face, pellucid eyes, and sincere smile prevented me from determining whether the time machine comment or any other off-the-wall business that came out of her was offered with total sincerity or in a spirit of fun. By the way, pellucid means translucently clear. There's other ones, but that's really the one that matches eyes. The rest of them are like mountains and shit. Like, seriously, you really want to know? All right, fine. You're just being nosy now. Translucently clear, lucid in style or meaning, or clear and pure in tone. Yeah, it had nothing to do with mountains, but one of the ones I had in sentences was mountains. Mountains reflected in the pellucid waters. Anyhow, that's a word that somebody's going to see on their SAT test, and you're very fucking welcome. Most people don't have fun while being held hostage and being threatened with death by the likes of Crinkles. I suspected, however, that Lori Lynn Hicks might be capable of it. I couldn't wait for her to meet my family. A lot of people don't actually have fun, even when they're at a party having fun. That's because they don't have a sense of humor. Everyone claims to have a sense of humor, but some of them are lying, and a significant number are fooling themselves. This explains the success of most TV sitcoms and movie comedies. These shows can be entirely humorless, but scads of people will laugh uproariously at them because they come with a label that says funny. The congenitally humor-challenged audience knows it is safe to laugh, that it's even expected. There's a show. Oh my God, I wish I could remember. The Big Bang Theory! I don't have to say more than that. Black folks understand. White people are like, what? This part of the entertainment business serves the community of the humorless in much the way that a manufacturer of prosthetic limbs serves those unfortunates who have lost arms or legs. Their work may be more important than feeding the poor. My family has always insisted on fun, not only during the sunny times of life, but also during times of adversity, even in the face of loss and tragedy. Though right now they must be sick with worry regarding my whereabouts. Maybe we inherited an acutely sensitive, funny recognition gene. Or maybe we're just on a permanent sugar high from all the baked goods we eat. No, said the nameless maniac. It's not a time machine, it's the bank's emergency generator. Too bad, Lori lamented. I'd rather it had been a time machine. Gazing wistfully at the generator, the maniac sighed. Yeah, I know what you mean. So you disabled the bank's emergency generator, I said. My statement harried him out of his time travel fantasy. How'd you know? I pointed. The parts scattered there on the floor were a clue. You're quick, he said with admiration. In my line of work, we have to be. He didn't ask what job I held. As I've learned over the past 10 years, psychopaths are routinely self-absorbed. The bank closed an hour ago, he said, clearly proud of his elaborate plan and gratified to have an opportunity to share it. The teller's drawers have been reconciled, and they've gone home. The vault will have been closed 10 minutes ago. By routine, the manager and the two security guards were the last to leave. Somewhere, Lori guessed, you've rigged a power company transformer to blow, cutting electrical service to the town square. When the power goes, I said, the generator won't cut in, and the vault will be vulnerable. You're both very quick, he said approvingly. What's the story with you two? Have you planned a heist before? Not in this reincarnation, Lori replied, but that's another story. He indicated the farther staircase. That leads to the half of the bank's upper basement where they fill coins, bundle cash, verify incoming money shipments, and prepare outgoing transfers. The front door to the vault is also in that area. The vault has a back door? I asked with a note of disbelief that amused him. He grinned, nodded, and pointed to the nearest staircase. The door at the top goes directly into the vault. This detail seemed to belong entirely in the maniac's distorted view of reality, and not at all in the real world that I inhabited. Pleased by my amazement, he said, Cornelius Snow was a sole stockholder in the bank when he built it. He arranged things for his convenience. Are we talking skullduggery here? Lori wondered, and seemed to be delighted that there may be some. Not at all, he assured her. From every indication, Cornelius Snow was an honest, civil-minded man. He was an insatiable, greedy, drooling pig. Crinkles angrily disagreed as he worked on another explosive charge. He didn't need to misappropriate any depositors' funds because 80% of the deposits were his to begin with. Crinkles had no interest in these facts of accounting, only in emotion. I would have roasted him on a spit and fed him to dogs. In the 1870s, the maniac said, there wasn't anything remotely like the complex web of regulation and oversight by which banks operate these days. Except dogs would have the good sense not to eat the venomous bastard, Crinkles added in a voice bitter enough to curdle milk. Shortly past the turn of the century, that simpler world began to fade away. Even inbred, starving sewer rats wouldn't have eaten the avaricious creep if you had bathed them in bacon grease, Crinkles elaborated. After Cornelius died, when the bulk of his estate was left to a charitable trust, the section of the tunnel leading to the bank's subterranean entrance was walled shut. I recalled the breach in the wall that we had passed through en route. The Beagle Boys had been busy. The steel door at the head of those stairs of the vault isn't actually operable, the nameless maniac continued. The old oak door was replaced with steel in the 1930s, then welded shut. And on the other side is a reinforced concrete block wall. But we can get through all that in maybe 2 hours, once we've dealt with the alarm. I'm surprised this room right here isn't alarmed, Lori said. Though I suppose if that was really a time machine, it would be. Nobody saw the need. To all appearances, this is not a major bank, not worth knocking over. Besides, after 1902, when they sealed off the underground approach, there wasn't a back entrance anymore. And in respect to the bank's security, the charitable trust that now owns the Snow Mansion agreed not to disclose Cornelius's tunnels. A few people in the historical society have seen them, but only after signing a non-disclosure agreement with teeth. Earlier, he had mentioned torturing a member of the historical society, who no doubt was now as dead as the librarian. No matter how tightly a lawyer constructs a non-disclosure clause, there are ways around it. I wouldn't say that I was thunderstruck by these revelations, but I was certainly flabbergasted, however fine a point that might be. Although born and raised in Snow Village, and although I loved my picturesque hometown and was steeped in its history, I had never heard so much as a rumor about secret passageways under the town square. When I expressed my amazement to the maniac, the warm twinkle in his eyes crystallized into a colder glitter that I recognized from the eyes of the killer, the Gila monster, and Earl the Milk Snake. You can't deeply, fully know a town, he said, if you love it. Loving it, you're charmed by surfaces. To deeply, fully know a town, you've got to hate it, loathe it, loathe it with an unquenchable, fiery passion. You've got to be consumed by a need to learn all its rotten, shameful secrets and use them against it. Find its hidden cancers and feed them until they metastasize into apocalyptic tumors. You've got to live for the day when its every stone and stick will be wiped forever from the face of the earth. I assumed that once upon a time, something bad had happened to him in our little tourist Mecca. Something more traumatic than giving a lesser hotel room when he had reserved a suite, or being unable to buy a ski lift pass on a busy winter weekend. But when you come right down to it, Lori said, somewhat riskily it seemed to me, this whole escapade isn't about hate or about justice like you said earlier. It's about bank robbery. It's just about money. The maniac's face turned so livid that from hairline to chin and from ear to ear, it looked like one big bruise. His smile went flatline. I don't care about money, he said so tightly that the words seemed to escape him without parting his fiercely compressed lips. You're not breaking into a produce market to steal a lot of carrots and snow peas, Lori said. You're robbing a bank. I'm destroying the bank to break the town. Money, 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 she persisted. This is about vengeance, well-deserved, long-overdue vengeance, and that's close enough to justice for me. Not for me it isn't, Crinkles interjected, leaving his work with the explosives to contribute to the conversation more directly. This is about money, because wealth isn't just wealth, but also the root and stalk and flower of power. And power liberates the powerful while it oppresses the powerless. So to crush what crushes, those who are oppressed must oppress the oppressors. Bars. I made no attempt to rerun that sentence through my memory banks. I was afraid that by trying to untangle it, my brain would crash. This was Karl Marx, filtered through a lens of Abbott and Costello. Aware from our expressions that his point had been too blunt to penetrate, Krinkle stated his philosophy more succinctly. Some of that filthy, stinking pig's money belongs to me, and to lots of other people he exploited to get it. Gee whiz, take a rest from stupid for a moment, Laurie told Crinkles. Cornelius Snow never exploited you. He died long before you were born. She was on a roll now, insulting everyone who had the power and the motivation to kill us. I shook my cupped hand, thereby shaking hers, to remind her that any spray of bullets she invited were likely to leave me dead as well. Crinkle's mass of wiry hair seemed to stiffen until he less resembled Art Garfunkel than he did the Bride of Frankenstein. What we're doing here is making a political statement, he insisted. Thus far phlegmatic compared to his companions, Honker joined them, so exacerbated by all this talk of vengeance and politics that his caterpillar eyebrows twitched as though jolts of an electric current enlivened them. Cash, he said. It's all it's about for me, cold cash. I'm here to take the money and run. If there wasn't a bank, I wouldn't have signed up for this. The rest of it doesn't matter to me. And if you guys don't shut up and get the job done, then I'm out of here, and you're on your own. Honker must have had skills essential to the heist, because his threat quieted his partners. Their fury, however, did not abate. They looked like thwarted attack dogs, held back on choke chains, faces dark with unspent rage, eyes hot with violent passion that would not cool until they had been allowed to bite. I wish that I had some cookies to give them. Maybe German Lebkuchen or some nice Scotch shortbread. Or chocolate pecan tarts. The poet William Congreve wrote, "Music has charms to soothe the savage beast, but I suspect good muffins are more effective." As if aware that his associate's submission to a threat did not constitute teamwork, Honker threw a bone at each man's mania, beginning with Crinkles. There's just a clock running, and we got a lot to do, that's all I'm saying, and if we just do the job, your political statement will be made, loud and clear. Crinkles bit his lower lip, in a manner reminiscent of our young president. Reluctantly, he nodded agreement. To the green-eyed maniac, Honker said, "You planned this caper because you want justice for your mother's death, so let's do the job and get that justice." The librarian killer's eyes grew misty, as they had done when his heartstrings had been strung by my revelation that my mother used to iron my socks. "I found issues of the newspaper to carry the story," he told Honker. "They must have been hard to read," Honker sympathized. "I felt like my heart was being ripped out. I could hardly force myself through them," his voice thickened with emotion. "But then I got so angry." "Understandable," Honker commiserated. "Each of us only gets one mother." "It wasn't just her being murdered. It was the lies, Honker. Almost everything in the newspaper was a lie." Glancing at his wristwatch, Honker shrugged and said, "Well, what do you expect from newspapers?" "Capitalist lapdogs is all they are," Crinkles observed. "They said my mother died in childbirth, and Dad shot the doctor in a mad rage, as if that makes any sense." "The nameless maniac could have been my age. To the day? To the hour? Almost to the minute? If he had gotten his good looks and green eyes from his mother..." Astonished, without thinking, I said, "Punchinello?" When Honker furrowed his forehead, his push-broom eyebrows swept shadows of suspicion over his eyes. Crinkle slipped his right hand inside his windbreaker, touching the butt of his holster pistol. The shooter in newspapers took a step back, startled that I knew his name. I said, "Punchinello Bizzo?" Chapter 15. The three clowns placed elasticity explosives and inserted synchronized detonators. Clowns they were, though not in costume. Honker, Crinkles, stage names that will seem entirely appropriate when they're cavorting in size 58 shoes, baggy polka dot pants, and bright orange wigs. Maybe Punchinello used his real name as a stage name. Or perhaps under the big top, he was known as Squiggles or Slappy. Either in the center ring or out here in the world of Rubes, the name of Nutsy also would have suited him. Lori and I sat on the stone floor, our backs against a row of green filing cabinets filled with historical records of the bank's first 100 years. Judging by the preparations being made around us, the building would implode 78 years short of its second century. I was in a mood. Although I wasn't yet gripped by terror, which overwhelms the will and paralyzes, my condition was well north of mere misgiving. Combined with my anxiety was a sense that fate had not dealt with me fairly. No family of good, kind-hearted bakers should have to be afflicted with two generations of Bezos. It'll be like after Churchill wins World War II, a week later a woman moves in next door with 26 cats and is Hitler's batty sister. Alright, that's not a brilliant analogy, or maybe not even one that makes any sense, but it expresses how I felt. Put upon, cruelly victimized, the innocent whipping boy for a universe gone mad. In addition to anxiety and a keen sense of injustice, I was tormented by a formless determination. Formless because determination requires a setting of limits within which one must act. But I did not know what those limits should be, didn't know what to do, when to do it, or how. I felt like throwing my head back and screaming in frustration. The only thing preventing me from doing so was the unnerving concern that when I screamed, Honker and Crinkles and Punchinello would scream wildly with me, honk horns, blow whistles, and squeeze rubber bladders that made a farting sound. Until that moment, I had never suffered from harlequinophobia, which is the fear of clowns. To often account, I had heard the story of the night I was born, the tale of the murderous chain-smoking fugitive from a circus, but never had Conrad Bezos' homicidal acts instilled in me an uneasiness about all clowns. In less than 2 hours, the lunatic son had achieved what the father could not. I watched him and his two subordinate Mary Andrews at work with the explosives, and they seemed to me to be alien in the most troubling sense. Like the pod people from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, passing for human beings, but with an ultimate agenda so dark and so strange that it lay beyond human comprehension. Like I said, I was in a mood. The Tock family's exquisitely sensitive funny recognition gene was still functioning. I remained aware of the screwball nature of the situation, but I did not feel in the least amused. Insanity is not evil, but all evil is insane. Evil itself is never funny, but insanity sometimes can be. We all need to laugh at the irrationality of evil, for in doing so we deny evil's power over us, diminish its influence on the world, and tarnish the allure it has for some people. There in the subcellar of the bank, I failed in my duty to deny, diminish, and tarnish. I was offended by fate, anxious, angry, and even Lori Lynn Hicks in all her glory could not lift my spirits. She had a lot of questions, as you might imagine. Usually, I enjoy recounting the story of the night of my birth, but not this time. Nevertheless, she got out of me the stuff about Conrad Bezos. She is indefatigable. I didn't mention my grandfather's predictions. If I brought up that subject, I'd almost inevitably also tell her that back in the newspaper morgue at the library, I'd experienced a semi-precognitive moment of my own. A premonition, sharper than a hunch, but fuzzy on the details, that she would be shot. I didn't see anything to be gained by alarming her, especially since my sudden sixth sense might be nothing but hooey, just a flare from an overheated imagination. Finished preparing explosives, the out-of-uniformed motley fools lit and placed a series of Coleman lanterns to illuminate the chamber when the power failed. They didn't have enough of them to brighten the entire big room, just the end at which they would be working on the vault. Lori and I were left sitting at a distance. When the electric lights went off, we would be in shadow. Having absorbed my story, Lori brooded for a moment and then said, "Are all clowns so angry?" I don't know a lot of clowns. You know these three and Conrad Bezos. I never met Conrad Bezos. I was like 5 minutes old when our paths crossed. I count that as a meet. So regarding clowns and anger, that's 4 for 4. I'm bummed. It's like when you meet the real Santa Claus and it turns out to have a drinking problem. You still have the shiv? The what? I asked. The shiv. You mean the nail file? If that's what you want to call it, she said. That's what it is. Whatever you say. When are you going to make your move? When the time's right, I said patiently. Let's hope that's before rather than after we're blown to smithereens. They had finished placing the 5 gas lanterns. One stood at the foot of the stairs, one at the middle of the long flight, and a third on the wide landing at the top, outside the back door to the vault. From a couple of large suitcases, Punchinello unpacked tools, welder masks, and other items I couldn't identify from a distance. Honker and Crinkles muscled a wheeled tank of acetylene up the stairs to the landing. Lori said, "What kind of name is Punchinello?" His father named him after a famous clown. You know, like Punch and Judy. Punch and Judy, your puppets, yes, I said, but Punch is also a clown. I didn't realize that. He wore a sort of a jester hat. She said, I thought Punch was a car salesman. Where'd you get that idea? It's just always the impression I had. Punch and Judy go all the way back to the 19th century. Maybe the 18th, I said. There weren't cars then. Well, who would want the same job for 2 centuries? Back then, before cars, he was probably a candle maker or a blacksmith. She's an enchantress. She casts a spell over you, and you find yourself wanting to see the world from her perspective. That's why I heard myself replying as if Punch were as real as she and I were. He's not a candle-making, blacksmithing sort of guy. That's just not him. He wouldn't be fulfilled in that kind of work. Besides, he wears a jester's hat. The hat doesn't prove anything. He could have been a hip sort of blacksmith with a funky style. She frowned. He's always going berserk and beating up Judy, isn't he? So that makes 5. 5 what? 5 angry clowns and no happy ones at all. To be fair, I said, Judy's always beating the crap out of him too. Is she a clown? I don't know, maybe. Well, Punch is her husband, so at the very least she's a clown by marriage. So that makes 6 of them, all angry. This is quite a revelation. Elsewhere in town, the transformer blew up. It must have been housed in an underground vault, for the rumble of the muffled blast seemed to translate laterally through the walls of the bank subcellar. Instantly, the electric lights went off. The farther end of the room glowed with lantern light, while Lori and I sat in gloom. Chapter 16. On the spacious landing at the top of the stairs, Honker and Crinkle stood in welder's masks, full-body fireproof aprons, and flared cuff asbestos gloves. With the acetylene torch, Honker cut open the steel perimeter of the steel door. Smiling, shaking his head, Punchinello dropped to one knee in front of Lori and me. "You're really Jimmy Tuck?" "James," I said. "Son of Rudy Tuck." "That's right. My father said Rudy Tuck saved his life." I said, "Dad might be surprised to hear that." "Well, Rudy Tuck is a modest man as well as a man of courage," Punchinello declared. "But when that phony nurse with a poison dagger in her fist was sneaking up behind the great Conrad Bezo, my father, he would have been a goner if your dad hadn't shot her dead." As I sat in stupefaction, Lori said, "I hadn't heard this part." To me, Punchinello said, "You haven't told her?" "He's just as modest as his father," Lori told Punchinello. As the smell of hot steel and molten welding compound spread through the room, Lori said, "What about the phony nurse?" Settling all the way to the floor, cross-legged in front of us, Punchinello said, "She was dispatched to the hospital to murder the great Conrad Bezo, my mother, and me." "Who dispatched her?" Lori wondered. Even in the shadows, I could see a fever of hatred flare in his remarkable eyes as he said through clenched teeth, "Virgilio Vivacementi." Under the pressurized circumstances, I heard her reply, which he delivered with more syllables than the words actually contained, as just an ear-pleasing series of meaningless syllables. Apparently, Lori made no more of it than I did because she said gesundheit. The hateful aerialists, he said acidly. The world-famous flying vivisementes. Trapeze artists. High-wire walkers. Overpaid prima donnas. The most arrogant, most pompous, most conceited, most overrated of them all is Virgilio. The paterfamilias. My mother's father. Virgilio vivisementi, swine of swines. Now, Lori said, that's not a nice thing to say about your grandfather. This admonition triggered a rush of rejection from Punchinello. I deny his right to be my grandfather. I refuse him, renounce him. I repudiate that old preening pile of crap. That sounds terribly final, Lori said. Personally, I pretty much always give a grandparent one more chance. Leaning towards her, eager to explain, Punchinello said, when my mother married my father, her family was shocked, furious, that a flying vivisemente should marry a clown. To them, aerialists are not merely the royalty of the circus, but demigods, while clowns are to them a lower life form, the scum of the big top. Maybe if clowns were less angry, Lori said, other circus people would like them more. He seemed not to hear her. So determined was he to make the case against his mother's family. When mother married the great Conrad Bezo, the aerialists first shunned her, then scorned her, then disinherited and disowned her. Because she married for love, married a man they considered to be beneath her class, she was not their daughter anymore. She was dirt to them. So, Lori said, let me get this straight. They were all in the same circus, your mom living on the clown end of the encampment with your father, the vivisemente family living in the upper class neighborhood, on the road together, but apart. The tension must have been uncomfortable. You can't even know. Every performance, the vivisementes prayed to Jesus that the great Beza would break his spine and be paralyzed for life when he was shot out of a cannon. In every performance, my father prayed to Jesus that their entire family would fall as one from their high trapezes and die horribly on impact within the center ring. Glancing at me, Lori said, wouldn't you like to have seen Jesus' face when he read their email? Breathless with the momentum of his story, Punchinello said, on the night that I was born here in Snow Village, Virgilio hired an assassin who came to the hospital disguised as a nurse. He would know where to find an assassin for hire on a moment's notice, she asked. Punchinello's voice wavered between the most caustic hatred and an abject fear. Virgilio vivisemente, that animated sewage that calls itself a man, he is connected. He sits the center of a web of evil. He plucks a strand and criminals half a world away feel the vibrations and answer them at once. He's a pompous charlatan and a fool, but he's also a venomous centipede, quick and vicious, supremely dangerous. He arranged to have us murdered while he and his devious family were performing an airtight alibi. This was the story of the night of my birth, as reimagined by a drunken lunatic. Punchinello had been nurtured on it instead of on mother's milk and love. Having heard the tale a thousand times, having been raised in an atmosphere of paranoid fantasy and hatred, he believed in this absurd history as idol worshippers once believed in the consciousness and divinity of solid gold calves and slabs of stone. And in the expectant father's lounge, he said, when the hired killer crept up on my father from behind, Rudy Tock entered at that very moment. Saw the fiend, drew his pistol, and shot her before she could carry out Virgilio's orders. Poor Lois Hansen, young and dedicated, murdered by a psychotic clown, had been transformed by that same clown from a nurse into a combination ninja assassin and baby-killing agent of King Herod. Patting my knee to snap me out of a trance of astonishment, Lori said, "Your dad carried a pistol?" I thought he was just a simple pastry chef. Back then, he was just a baker, I said. Wow, what's he packing now that he's become a pastry chef? A submachine gun? Compelled to tell his woeful tale, Punchinello impatiently pressed on. Saved by Rudy Tock, my father realized my mother and I too were in great danger. he rushed into the maternity ward, located the delivery room, and arrived as the doctor was suffocating me. Me, an innocent newborn. The doctor was a phony too? Lori asked. No. McDonald was a real doctor, but he had been corrupted by Virgilio Vivacemente, that worm from the bowels of a syphilitic weasel. Weasels can get syphilis? Lori wondered. He chose to consider this a rhetorical question and continued. Dr. McDonald was paid an enormous sum, a fortune, to make it appear that my mother died in childbirth and that I was stillborn. Virgilio may be cast into hell tonight. Believe that the oh-so-precious Vivacemente blood had been polluted by the great Conrad Bezo, and that my mother and me, being tainted, must be eradicated. What a vile man, Lori said, as if she actually believed any of this. I told you, Punchinello cried. He's lording a festering canker on Satan's ass. That is low, Lori agreed. Conrad Bezo shot Dr. McDonald as he tried to suffocate me. My mother, my beautiful mother, she was already dead. That's some story, I said. For I was concerned that I might be seen as one of Virgilio's minions if I drew attention to any of the numerous absurdities in this nuthouse theater version of those long-ago events. But Virgilio Vivacemente, that spawn of a witch's toilet. Ooh, I like that one, Lori interrupted. That animated dog vomit knew how corrupt this town was, how easily he could conceal the truth. He bribed the police, the local journalists. The official story is an outrageous concoction of lies reported in the Gazette. I managed to sound sympathetic to his version. Sounds like such a transparent concoction when you know the truth. He nodded vigorously. Rudy Tock must have been frustrated to have silence imposed on him all these years. Dad took no money from Virgilio, I hastened to assure him, fearing that he might later take a spin across town to gun down Dad, Mom, and Weena. Not a penny. No, of course he didn't, Punchinello said, and apologized effusively if I had inferred such an accusation. Conrad Bezo, my father, has impressed on me what a courageous man of integrity Rudy Tock is. I know they must have silenced him in some brutal fashion. Understanding Punchinello's psychology well enough to suspect that only wild exaggeration and flamboyant lies had a ring of truth to him, I said, they beat Dad once a week for years. This evil town. But that alone wouldn't have silenced them, I added. They threatened to kill my grandma Rowena if he talked. They beat her too, said Lori. Whether she intended to be helpful or mischievous, I could not tell. But they only beat her once, I said. Summoning a credible note of outrage, Lori revealed, they knocked out her teeth. Only two teeth, I hastened to correct, concerned that we might overplay the lie. They tore off her ear. Not her ear, I said quickly. Her hat. Oh, I thought it was her ear, Lori said. It was her hat, I insisted in a tone of voice that said enough is enough. They tore off her hat and stomped on it. Punchinello Bezo buried his face in his hands, muffling his voice. Tore off an old lady's hat. An old lady's hat. We've all suffered at the hands of these monsters. Before Lori could claim that Virgilio's henchman had cut off Grandma Rowena's thumbs, I said, where's your father been these past 20 years? Dropping his mask of fingers, he said, on the run. Always moving, two steps ahead of the law, but barely one step ahead of Vivacemente's private detectives. He raised me in a dozen different places. He was forced to give up the big career. The great Conrad Bezo reduced to taking clown positions with smaller shows and demeaning jobs like children's party clown, car wash clown, dunk the clown in the carnival. Living under false names, Cheezo, Giggles, Clappo, Saucy. Saucy? Lori asked. Blushing, Punchinello said, for a while he was a clown MC in a strip club. He was so humiliated. The men who go to that place, they didn't appreciate his genius. All they cared about were boobs and butts. Philistines, I sympathize. Grieving, despairing, in a constant seething fury, terrified that an agent of the Vivacementes would find him at any moment, he was as good a father as he could be under the circumstances. Though Conrad Beazle had lost all capacity to love when he lost my mother. Hollywood can make a great tearjerker out of this, Laurie said. Punchinello agreed. My father thinks Charles Bronson should play him. The absolute king of tearjerkers, Laurie said. My childhood was cold, loveless, but there were compensations. By the time I was 10, for instance, in preparation for the day I might have to stalk and destroy Virgilio Vivacementi, I had learned an enormous amount about guns, knives, and poisons. Other 10-year-old boys have nothing useful in their heads, Laurie said. Just baseball, video games, and collecting Pokemon cards. I didn't get love, but at least he kept me safe from the vicious Virgilio. And he did his best to teach me all the craft and the technique that had made him a legend in his profession. A hard clang, like the tone of a tuneless bell, pealed through the room. At the top of the stairs, having torched open a steel door, Honker and Crinkles torqued it from its frame and dropped it on the landing. "I've got to do my part now," Punchinello said. His anger and hatred dimmed as if on a rheostat, while warmth and what passed for affection brightened his face. "But don't worry. When this is done, Jimmy, I'll protect you. I know we can trust you not to rat us out. Nothing will happen to the son of Rudy Tock." "What about me?" Laurie asked. "You'll have to be killed," he said without hesitation, his smile fading into a bland robotic expression, his eyes abruptly empty of compassion. While all evil is insane and while some insanity could be funny from a comfortable distance, few insane people have a sense of humor. If Punchinello had one, it wasn't wry enough to produce a line like that. I knew at once that he was serious. He would release me but kill Laurie. As he rose to his feet and moved away, shock briefly silenced me. And then I called out, "Punch, wait! I've got a secret to tell you." He turned to me. His dark emotions became light as rapidly as a flock of birds radically altering its flight path to catch a sudden change of wind. The robot had vanished, and the cold stare. Now he was all glamour and fellowship, good looks, great hair, twinkling best friend eyes. "Laurie," I told him, "is my fiance." He paid out one of those million-dollar smiles. "Fantastic! You'd make a perfect couple." "Not sure he got the point," I said. "We're going to be married in November. We'd like you to come to the wedding if that's possible, but there can't be a wedding if you kill her." Smiling, nodding, he considered this as I held my breath. And considered it. And considered it. Finally, he said, "I only want happiness for the son of Rudy Tock, my father's savior and mine. This will be tricky with Honker and Crinkles, but we'll work it out." The "thank you" came out of me in an explosive exhalation. He left us and proceeded to the stairs. However reluctant she might have been to show weakness, Laurie could not repress a shudder of relief that chattered her teeth. When Punchinello was out of earshot, she said, "Let's get one thing straight, Baker boy. I'm not naming the first kid either Conrad or Beazo." 916-633-1537, wretchedandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. You can leave a review on Spotify. It takes like 13 seconds. You can also leave a review on Podchaser. Copy and paste that into Apple Podcasts, and then copy and paste that into the Good Pods app. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/singlesimulcast. $1 will get you a ton of content. You can also donate to the show at buymeacoffee.com/sscast or on the Good Pods app. You can leave a tip in the tip jar. Thank you so much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Y'all be good. I'm going to holler at you later. Peace.
Intro.
intro and outro to Ratchet Book Club is by That Kid Garan, and it's called Goodbyes. You can email him at tkgbeats94@gmail.com for more information on how to lease this beat.
This is Single Simulcast.